I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held the first of several public hearings this month. This was after conducting 1,000 interviews and compiling tens of thousands of pages of documents. Chair Benny Thompson and Vice Chair Liz Cheney did not mince their words, outlining evidence that they say will show that former President Donald Trump orchestrated the coup, the deadly assault on the Capitol, even though aides and members of his administration told him he had lost the election to Joe Biden. They said that Trump supported the hanging of his Vice President Mike Pence, something the mob was shouting for, and that some members of Trump's cabinet talked about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him from office. Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards, who was injured in the melee, gave this searing testimony about what she saw that day in this lightly edited clip.
I couldn't believe my eyes. There were officers on the ground. I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood. You know, I was catching people as they fell. It was carnage. It was chaos. I can't even describe what I saw. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that as a police officer, as a law enforcement officer, I would find myself in the middle of a battle. You know, I'm trained to detain, you know, a couple of subjects and handle a crowd, but I'm not combat trained. I just remember that moment of stepping behind the line and just seeing the absolute war zone that the West Front had become.
Today on Radio Times, what did we learn on that day about the January 6th attack on the Capitol? What does it mean, and where do things go from here? We have two guests who have joined us. Ankush Kadari is a contributing writer for New York Magazine, a contributing editor for Politico, and a former federal prosecutor. Ankush Kadari, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, also a CNN contributor and editor of a new book called The Presidency of Donald Trump, A First Historical Assessment. Julian Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I wanted to begin with that clip just as a reminder. I mean, I think if people watched last night, you saw the video as a reminder about the kind of, as Edwards describes, the carnage, the chaos, the war zone that was the U.S. Capitol. And I wonder for you, Julian Zelizer, is there concern that we've gotten used to what this insurrection looked like, and we're seeing it as kind of an everyday occurrence in America?
Well, I do think the committee is worried about that, or at least worried that people don't remember the horror of what actually took place that day. It's just something discussed in the past rather than the feelings that were evoked as it happened. And I think playing the video, having the testimony from an officer was meant to really remind people this was not a tour, as some Republicans have said. It wasn't simply a rally. This was a violent attack, and the video they showed really captured that. That said, it's a challenge for the committee. I mean, this is happening after a long time after the events took place. Right. Public is focused on other issues. So I think the committee's starting by trying to bring us backward and to remember what we're talking about here.
Ankush, speaking broadly, how would you say the committee did first day, sort of laying out where, what they know, and what they're going to tell us in future hearings?
You know, I thought if we were to sort of think of this as the opening statement in a case, it was very well done, very well constructed, very well executed. You know, Chairman Thompson set up the stakes very nicely, you know, why we should care. And then Liz Cheney sort of went through fairly methodically what they intend to present. Right. I will say, you know, the opening statement in a trial always sounds good. It always sounds persuasive.
Because you have the floor, right?
You have the floor. You haven't heard anything from the other side. There won't really be another side here, not in the committee room. But you don't have the other side, but, you know, you have the power to kind of stitch together a bunch of different pieces of evidence, right? And to to clip things the way they did and to isolate things and to emphasize things. I think from a legal perspective on some important issues, I think we kind of saw some of the seams showing, if mm-hmm. you will, and mm-hmm. just to give you the starkest example, and we can talk about this more, you know, particularly like connecting up Trump's knowledge and people in the White House and campaigns' advanced knowledge of potential violence on January 6th to the violence itself. I think we could detect that they've had some difficulty connecting the two in a very explicit way. And then my last kind of major takeaway is I don't think that that is the committee's fault. I think that what they've been doing is very unprecedented, right? 10, 11 months from start of this investigation to hearings, an extraordinary amount of evidence has been gathered, but they have not had the cooperation of Republicans, of senior officials in the Trump White House. And I really think Jared Kushner's body language said everything about the seriousness with which they took this.
He was sort of sitting back and rolling his eyes and you know, being sort of snarky in response to the question. I think it came from Liz Cheney.
Well, he didn't want to be there. I mean, recall what he was asked was about Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel's behavior, which Kushner described as whining, threatening to resign. The White House counsel and his team of lawyers threatening to resign, he called whining. And then, you know, I think for watching at home, you run that up against what we heard a little bit later in the night, a Capitol Police officer describing, you know, her feet slipping in blood.
So comparing and contrasting the two. Hold on one second. Let me just go back to you, Julian, and just to sort of underscore something that Chairman Thompson talked about. He talked about President Lincoln during the Civil War, thinking that perhaps he might lose his election, and there was an election in the middle of the Civil War. And he writes down and has members of his cabinet write down that if we lose, we will, you know, essentially give up power and leave office in the middle of a Civil War. Just to put a kind of a fine exclamation point on what Trump did and how historic that is.
Yeah, I mean, the example itself is a very compelling one in terms of the centrality of the loser accepting the loss in our democratic system. And he's picking a moment of the most turbulence that we've had in this country where Lincoln understands the stakes of losing power. It's not simply about his authority. That's about the direction of the country, but lays that principle out clearly. And when you listen to last night's hearings, the opening arguments, for their flaws and strengths, the overall story is really something pretty unprecedented. I mean, they are suggesting that the former president was involved, along with top allies and the administration, in a coup. And January 6th is only going to be part of the story. January 6th needs to be seen in the context of an effort to overturn election results. And we heard testimony. Former Attorney General Barrs is the one people are talking about, where early on it was understood he lost. So this is a pretty big story to tell. That's different than whether there'll be any fallout. But I think that's going to be the essence of the hearings.
Well, let's play that video. And this is a video showing Donald Trump's former Attorney General Bill Barr recalling his conversation with the president in the month leading up to the January 6th attack. And I just should say to our listeners, we did not bleep out the expletive. Let's give it a listen.
I've been through sort of the give and take of those discussions. And in that context, I made it clear I did not agree with the idea of saying the election was stolen and putting out this stuff, which I told the president was bullshit. And, I didn't want to be a part of it. And that's one of the reasons that went into me deciding to leave when I did. I observed, I think it was on December 1st, that, you know, you can't live in a world where the incumbent administration stays in power based on its view, unsupported by specific evidence, that there was fraud in the election.
Ankush, let me go back to you. And that was obviously former Attorney General Bill Barr. There were others that told former President Donald Trump he had lost the election. He continues to this day to promote the big lie, as it is called. But as a legal matter, if you're the president of the United States and everyone tells you you've lost and all the evidence tells you you've lost and you refuse to give up power, is that a crime?
Well, we have no precedent from like the criminal justice system. You know, the committee has taken the position, right, in litigation that that can be a crime, that knowingly advancing false factual claims and legal claims in an effort to sort of overturn the election results or stop the certification, to be more precise, would run afoul of at least a couple different criminal statutes. And the judge out in California overseeing that litigation sort of
Carter,
ancillary
right?
to the
January, Carter.
Yeah, Judge Carter. Endorsed that theory. You know, it's definitely on the table. I mean, I think it's a theory everyone has to take seriously. Whether the Department of Justice takes it seriously or would seriously pursue it or attempt to get to Trump, entirely separate questions.
Well, Julian, and this is quoting a former President Trump from something he posted recently, maybe even yesterday, on his new social media site. He said January 6th was not simply a protest. It represented the greatest movement in the history of our country to make America great again. So he continues to spread the falsehood that he won the election.
Correct. And there in that tweet or not tweet, whatever we call it, he's doubling down on the connection between himself and what happened and really boasting about January 6th rather than distancing himself from it. So it's not only the lies about 2020. We also have ongoing efforts to influence local elections that will matter very much in 2024 and in the process next time around. So this is not simply about the past. I think the committee will want to get at that. This is about shoring up our system so that this does not become normalized and that it can't happen in the future. But there's many people right now surrounding Trump, including himself, who are totally committed to the narrative that was at the heart of what we saw last night.
And there is a lot of Republican support, Julian, for this as well. When you look at polling, there's such a stark split between Republicans and Democrats with independents kind of in between.
Absolutely. And in many ways, the effort worked. It didn't work in getting the result that the former president wanted, meaning to stay in power. But the party has, much of the party, Liz Cheney's really an outlier, has surrounded itself around these arguments. And it's the new unifying theme in many ways of the Republicans. It's what anti-communism was in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. Now it's election denialism. And so that's a dangerous place, I think, for one of the two major parties to be in.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Also with us, Ankush Kadari, a contributing writer for New York Magazine, a contributing editor for Politico, and a former federal prosecutor. We are talking about the January 6th hearing, the first of several this month that aired last night in prime time. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests about last night's hearing, the House Committee investigation into what led up to the insurrection January 6, 2021, and where things go from here. Let me play one more clip, and this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney explaining that advisors, family, and lawmakers repeatedly asked and pleaded with Trump to tell the mob to leave and to call in more law enforcement, something he refused to do. Let's give it a listen.
Not only did President Trump refuse to tell the mob to leave the Capitol, he placed no call to any element of the United States government to instruct that the Capitol be defended. He did not call his Secretary of Defense on January 6th. He did not talk to his Attorney General. He did not talk to the Department of Homeland Security. President Trump gave no order to deploy the National Guard that day, and he made no effort to work with the Department of Justice to coordinate and deploy law enforcement assets. But Vice President Pence did each of those things.
Ankush, then there was a video clip of General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who said that Vice President Cheney called and was, you know, yelling and practically screaming to bring in some military. Then he gets a call from Mark Meadows, and Mark Meadows says, we have to kill the narrative that the vice president is making all the decisions. We need to establish the narrative that the president is still in charge and that things are steady or stable, something that Milley said was basically politics, politics, politics. How significant was it that Trump did not do any of those things?
Well, I think from a political perspective, or sort of the perspective of like fitness for public office in the future, because this man may be on the ballot again, highly significant. I hope he's not, he does not return to power. From a legal perspective, just strictly like, you know, if you're trying to evaluate Trump's potential legal liability, you know, I think one, some people have tried to say that, you know, his inadvertence or his failure to do anything might expose him to criminal liability. In theory, I'm very dubious. But I think the more potent legal and factual point was, like, he really wanted this to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was fine mm-hmm. with it happening. He wanted to see if it would succeed. He was content to watch the violence and let it play out for several hours with the possibility that it might actually work. Now, whether the Justice Department will do anything about that, or if that's a, you know, rises to a sufficient level to charge the former president, again, those are very separate questions, and we can get into that. But that is, I think, was the main takeaway to me. Like, right. He was happy with what he saw.
But is that dereliction of duty? Does it meet that definition?
It's dereliction of duty, but that's not a crime just by itself, right? There are people who have argued that, like, simply dereliction of duty in this instance might be a criminal offense. I really am very skeptical of that theory, particularly in factual circumstances as novel and unique as these. I think the better argument would be, if you were really trying to pursue it and aggressively pursue it, would be, well, this establishes that Trump intended to incite the insurrection when he gave his speech at the Ellipse, because he didn't try to stop the violence when he saw it.
Julian, you want to add to that? And there were plenty of other either speeches or tweets that the president, then President Trump, said leading up to both the election and then after the election and then leading up to January 6th and, frankly, after January 6th. You want to comment on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, part of what's going on isn't simply that we are, you know, past the event itself, but so much of this was done in broad daylight. A lot of the former president's speeches, the famous moment in the debate where he essentially sends a message to the Proud Boys, which we now know helped to boost their membership, his embrace of a false argument about the election, we saw it all. We listened to it all. So the committee has a tough job in that it was all out there. He got rid of the smoking gun in some ways by just doing it in public. This was a method, I think, the former president used. So part of what the committee is trying to really emphasize, it seems, is that there was an intentionality and understanding of the danger that was brewing, the physical danger, not just the electoral danger. And the president was okay with that, either by not bringing in the forces that were needed to stop potential violence, or the comment we heard last night that he had a degree of sympathy with the hang Mike Pence message. And the second is just how orchestrated this all was. So we know he was involved. We know the connections. But I think they want to fill out the behind the scenes to show this wasn't simply the former president being Donald Trump and just saying what was on his mind, that there's a plot that took place from the election forward, where January 6th was the most violent manifestation, but he knew exactly what he was doing, and his aim was clear.
And he was pressuring then Vice President Mike Pence. He did it at when he gave the speech on January 6th, and both publicly and privately. Let me play one more clip, and then Ankush, I'll give you a chance to respond to that. And then we got a lot of comments here that I want to read. And this is again Vice Chair Liz Cheney explaining that President Trump was so angry at Vice President Pence for not refusing to certify Biden's victory that he actually sided with the rioters. Let's give it a listen.
And aware of the rioters' chance to hang Mike Pence, the president responded with this sentiment, quote, maybe our supporters have the right idea. Mike Pence, quote, deserves it.
You know, Ankush, when I heard that last night, when Cheney made that comment, I literally gasped.
Yeah, it was really striking. I think for me, what I was curious about was who heard it.
Yeah.
And I think this exposes kind of a broader challenge for the committee, which is that, as you know, Professor Zelizer indicated, so much of this was out in broad daylight. What the committee could have or at least hoped to excavate, right, was what was going on behind the scenes. But I think what we saw last night told us a lot about how little cooperation that they have gotten from not just, you know, Republicans who are currently working politically, but the former people, you know, the former administration officials, because, you know, they have not really filled out in a robust way or, you know, a courageous way what really was going on behind the scenes. And, you know, the committee understandably, you know, is looking for a sort of a hero, right, or someone we should mm-hmm. look up to in this series of events. The closest that they got, someone truly who has fully clean hands, was a Capitol Police officer, right? A true hero, right? True. All of those people. But what we lack here is someone from within the administration who can say, look, I was speaking up. I was complaining about this. I was telling him vociferously. You know, Barr tried to position himself as potentially that person, but really he was not. He shoulders a lot of the blame for all of the hysteria around the election. But, you know, where was Pence, by the way? You know, there's this desire to fill Pence out as maybe the hero of these events. And I get that. He did the right thing on January 6th. But did he ever object to Trump personally about all of the stuff he was doing in the months? Doesn't sound like it.
That's the kind of John Dean character, Julian Zelizer, who was, I mean, he did go to prison for his violations, but nonetheless was considered or is considered, you know, the hero or a hero of Watergate.
No, that's true. And that is a good comparison, or at least a reminder that sometimes the villains can emerge, or people who are involved in a crime can emerge as the heroes in these kinds of committee hearings. But I think it's correct. I mean, it's a little hard to make a hero of either the former Attorney General Barr or the former Vice President, who really were involved in everything that led up to the post-election, campaign, and even were involved in some of that campaign. Yes, they broke at the end, but my gosh, if that's what it takes to get you to break from an administration that's up to these sorts of things, I think it's hard for much of the public to have great sympathy at this point for your revelations.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Chris. He says, we need to stop calling Trump former president. He tried to overthrow the government, doesn't deserve respect. He also shouldn't get protection from the Secret Service. Chris, he was president of the United States for 4 years. He was sworn in, and he was either, the 45th, 46th? I've kind of lost track of how many presidents we've had, but he was our president. An email from Patty. I doubt that people who need to watch will actually watch the proceedings. And if they did, they consider it all lies. Millions of voters still support him. And the fact that he was part of a coup, the fact that he could still win the presidency horrifies me. Ankush, I want to ask you something. As we know, there are a number of people who have defied subpoenas. And, you know, I'm assuming if someone came to my front door with a subpoena and I defied them, I would be taken away in handcuffs and be put in jail, you know, until there was some kind of legal proceeding. I don't understand why a subpoena, at least coming from Congress, doesn't have particular clout.
Yeah, well, you know, a couple of people, as your question reflects, have successfully defied full compliance with the subpoenas. From the Justice Department's perspective, let me just lay out their perspective. For a contempt case, they would really want to be able to show that the person refusing to comply had no valid good faith basis. And I think what their position appears to be with respect to Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino, who they declined to charge with contempt of Congress, that these guys did engage at least somewhat and have, you know, therefore, like, weren't totally blowing off the committee. I am not totally satisfied with that, that thinking, because, you know, on one hand, you know, it provides a rationale for what how the DOJ distinguished between those two and Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon. But I think the flip side of that is sort of unavoidable. But the flip side of it is they have now provided a roadmap for senior White House officials for how not to comply with congressional subpoenas and get away with it. All you have to do is get a lawyer and sort of have them string the committee along and give them some stuff and then stop. And you're good.
Yeah, worrisome. Here's a question from Leslie. Julian, I'll send it over to you. She says, I'm not a fan of Sean Hannity, but he questioned why Nancy Pelosi did not agree to have troops there the night before. I thought that was Trump's call, and it is true that higher-ups in Congress refused to allow troops on January 6th. So she's asking that as a question. And it is pretty clear, when you revisit some of this video, how vulnerable the Capitol was and how obviously vulnerable the Capitol police officers were, and there was some foreknowledge that there was going to be some kind of a rally that day. Julian?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two different issues, and we have to be careful with the Speaker Pelosi in that the former president, and we should call him former president because he was, and I think it actually amplifies what we're talking about here in terms of a coup. What we're talking about with the former president is intentionally withholding troops or protection because he essentially supported the people on the ground and what they were doing. The question with Speaker Pelosi, who the former president has often targeted and said it was her fault, he said this several times, it might have not been planned well. And I think there's legitimate questions that are separate, really, from a lot of what the hearings are focused on in terms of what the preparation estimate what kind of was coming their way.
Okay, and we just had a little tiny glitch there, Julian, which is why I let out a little tiny, but you're with us, so that's good. Let me play another clip.
I'm here.
Yeah, no, that's good. We didn't want to lose you. Let me play another clip, and again, this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney. She's describing how a number of senior Justice Department officials threatened to resign and confronted Donald Trump. She contrasted their efforts to those of Trump's Justice Department appointee Jeffrey Clark and a number of Republican lawmakers like Pennsylvania Representative Scott Perry. Let's give this a listen.
Representative Scott Perry, who is also involved in trying to get Clark appointed as Attorney General, has refused to testify here. As you will see, Representative Perry contacted the White House in the weeks after January 6th to seek a presidential pardon. Multiple other Republican congressmen also sought presidential pardons for their roles in attempting to overturn the 2020 election.
Ankush is seeking a pardon, some, if not admission of guilt, concern about guilt?
I wouldn't say it's an admission, right? It's certainly concern, but, you know, it's sort of like invoking your Fifth Amendment right to not testify against yourself. Right? You have the right. It doesn't, you know, invoking it doesn't necessarily mean you've engaged in criminal misconduct. It means you're concerned that someone else might think you have engaged in criminal misconduct, and that could include a politically motivated future administration. I don't think that was a legitimate, like, that concern was legitimate, particularly given, you know, who we have, which is Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland. But, you know, just by itself asking for a pardon, you know, I wouldn't say is tantamount to admission, but it certainly they were concerned, and rightly so.
And rightly so. Julian, it's interesting to toggle back and forth between the insurrection and also that we're up on the 50th anniversary of the break-in at Watergate and what that did to the Nixon administration. Not precise parallels, but you know, there were those missing minutes on the phone logs for President, then President Nixon. We've got 187 minutes from the afternoon of January 6th where we really don't know what Trump was doing. Apparently, there are gaps in White House phone records that add up to 457 minutes. So there are some gaping holes here and some interesting parallels.
There are. I mean, look, at one level, both are about the abuse of presidential power. That said, there are differences. I mean, a lot of what was revealed through those tapes in the Watergate hearings, the one that became public as a result of the committee investigation, was to actually find evidence of what was being accused. In this case, in the Watergate case, the obstruction of justice. And when Congress actually heard Nixon talking about this, that became a smoking gun. But I'm not sure what we will find in the missing minutes that totally transforms the basic narrative we already have that has been filled out with evidence from the public record. So I think that's part of the difference. But obviously, the more we know, the more that the committee can produce or find about every minute of that day, the better our understanding is of how that abuse of power took place.
And Ankush, you wrote a piece in Politico, seven big questions for the January 6th committee. One of them, what was Trump doing in the White House throughout the 3 hours of rioting? I mean, how essential, I guess, to at least get some feeling about what was he doing? I think we know a little bit, but nonetheless, the significance of that question.
Yeah, I mean, the significance of the question, again, there's a political significance if this man decides to run again, or just a historical significance if he didn't decide to run again. You know, as a legal matter, it's the same kind of sort of the implications are similar to, you know, just the broader failure to act, if you will. But, you know, I think we have a fairly decent sense of what he was doing through you know, journalistic accounts that, you know, seem to have been borne out by the committee's work. I think we're going to find out. But we don't have the kind of minute by minute, like, you know, identifying what was happening in relation to other things and like kind of a full TikTok or, you know, timeline. It looks like the committee has, certainly the committee has aspired to assemble that. But again, they are significantly hampered by, you know, in order to assemble a timeline like that, you need people around him who are fully forthright and cooperating with you. People like Mark Meadows. You need them to testify in order to fill out that timeline.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Ankush Kadori, again, a contributing writer for New York Magazine, a contributing editor for Politico, and a former federal prosecutor. Julian Zelizer is also with us, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a CNN contributor, editor of a new book, The Presidency of Donald Trump, A First Historical Assessment. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about what we learned from last night's House Select Committee hearing into the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Jane. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but she says, I followed all the information since the attack on our Capitol on January 6, and I found the new information from the hearing deeply disturbing. She goes on to say, I am afraid for our country. A tweet from David, biggest problem is that so many people don't care, think, or know about our country or its government. A comment from Brian, if Trump had just conceded and put the country above himself, we would never be in this mess. It's reprehensible what he did and what he has started. Let me go back to something that Liz Cheney laid out. She talked about a seven-part conspiracy to overturn the election. And Ankush, I'll start with you, but she talked about, as the committee sees it, that the president, the former president, lied to the American people ignored evidence that he had actually lost the election. He pressured state and federal officials to toss election results. He encouraged a violent mob. He supported the execution of his then vice president and did nothing to stop the violence. Now, obviously, we've got some hearings ahead, and I'm assuming they're going to flesh some of this out in the hearings. The next one is Monday morning. But nonetheless, as you put these seven, what they describe as conspiracies out there, does that have a kind of coherence to you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought they presented a sort of a coherent theory of a case. It sort of hangs together. Right. What evidence they managed to adduce to shore it up, we got some of that last night, and we'll get some of it going forward. But just to take like one of them,
sure.
Right? He supported the most salacious one, if you will. He supported the hanging of Mike Pence. That sounds really awful, obviously. And at a minimum, you know, Trump acted terribly during this situation. But who heard that comment,
mm-hmm.
right? What was Trump's tone? What context was he saying it in? How seriously did he mean it? Those are the sorts of questions that you can only really get answered with a witness's testimony or having access to the raw sort of underlying information. And that's why I think it's, you know, I was watching it last night, obviously, like the rest of us. It was a very, very good opening statement. But going forward, I really want to see how they fill out some of the claims, what was supporting some of the claims that Liz Cheney made last night in completeness.
Well, he did pressure state and federal officials, or certainly to state officials. We know from his phone call to the Secretary of State of Georgia. I'm tossing that back to you, Ankush. I mean, that's, you know, he said it, we heard it.
Absolutely right. And that's a call I've written a bunch about.
I bet.
Outrageous, deserving of the highest level of legal scrutiny at the Justice Department. I don't think it's getting that, unfortunately. But that call alone was deserving of the highest level of legal scrutiny by the Justice Department, even before we get to January 6th. But, you know, the thing that I am hoping that, well, the committee has basically said that they're going to tell us that there was more of that.
Right.
And we got inklings of that sort of reporting in real time, but that's something I'm very, very keen to learn about, right? Like, we knew, for instance, that a couple of lawmakers from the Michigan state legislature visited the White House, but we really don't know what was said during that meeting. My guess is the Raffensperger call was not a one-off, and that there were a lot of other communications like that. It sounded like a call that he had made before, and that he was pretty well-versed in how to sort of make his case. And so I really want to learn more about that. I'm looking forward to that.
And Julian, what do you learn more of? What do you want to learn more of?
Well, I want to learn more of that, not just for understanding that day and what the administration was up to, but, you know, there are reforms that are being discussed right now, such as the Electoral Count Act reform, which has some bipartisan support. And the more we know about where Trump saw vulnerabilities and weaknesses that he could exploit in the election process itself and in the certification process, I think the better positioned legislators will be who are interested in reform to move forward and saying, so that can't happen. We want to push this legislation. And secondly, look, yes, we need to know more about who heard that remark from the former president, but we're talking about someone who might very well be running again in 2024. So his mindset, his comments, what he did or didn't do are very important in many ways for the next election. And so that voters know exactly what we're talking about if he decides to throw his hat in the ring, and for the Republican Party more broadly. Liz Cheney said it very clearly. That they will live with the dishonor of supporting this once he is gone. And there are people involved in the insurrection who are on the ticket right now, including in states like Pennsylvania.
Right.
So the more we know, the more they are under scrutiny as well.
Well, let me play that clip from Representative Vice Chair, Republican Vice Chair from Wyoming, Liz Cheney, addressing her Republican colleagues who are defending former President Donald Trump.
In our country, we don't swear an oath to an individual or a political party. We take our oath to defend the United States Constitution. And that oath must mean something. Tonight, I say this to my Republican colleagues who are defending the indefensible. There will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain.
Is that kind of, Julian, like a cancer on the presidency?
Well, I think it's more a cancer on the party.
And, well, that's what I mean, but yes.
No, but I'm saying that's a difference. You know, Watergate culminates with a group of senior Republicans, including Barry Goldwater, telling Nixon, you're done. We will not support you if impeachment reaches the Senate. That hasn't happened in this case. And in fact, just the opposite. More and more Republicans are supporting what's called Trumpism and what's called election denialism. And so I think the story here is in some ways broader. Has the entire party basically, connected itself to this legacy and to this moment? And right now, there's very little evidence they're separating themselves. So, yes, I think it's even broader because that party's very much alive. It's not resigning like Nixon did. And it's on the ticket in 2022 and 2024, regardless of what Trump does.
Ankusha, how do you see that quote? And how do you see the Republican Party in this whole mess?
Look, I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things I'm hoping we get out of this, these hearings or the coverage of it, is sort of to expand the aperture, if you will, outside of Trump. Just yesterday morning, if I recall correctly, it was yesterday morning, the day before, Kevin McCarthy was in front of a podium discrediting this committee, preemptively discrediting this committee. And then what did we see last night? We saw video from within his office, his own staffers running. Well, now, we don't know what was in their heads, but my guess is some of them were literally running for their lives. And this man has put up every obstacle possible to this committee's creation, to its operation. He wants to be the next Speaker of the House. He has no business in public life. He has no business in public life. If we didn't know that before last night, we saw it last night. His own staff, he does not care.
Well,
and, you know, oh, sorry, I was just going to say, you know, it's important, I think, to get a picture not just of the Trump, but like all of these lower level enablers, right? All of these people who had the ability to speak up, say no, do their own thing, their own small part to slow this down, either facilitated it actively or did nothing, essentially.
Or waited until they had a book to sell. I'll just add that. Just add that to it. But Julian, what we also know is what McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, and others said shortly after January 6th about what had happened and Trump's responsibility or even involvement. And now they've come, you know, now they changed their tune.
Well, it's not even now. I mean, McConnell kind of went along with the president's efforts, and there were many moments where he said the president can challenge the election results and didn't really take a strong stand. The only time he takes a strong stand privately is after the chaos is unfolding, and then after the second impeachment is done and fails, that's when McConnell made his speech, but then he reverted right back to McConnell's silence on these issues. And now he has not been supportive of these investigations. There were earlier versions he basically prevented. And so those moments, again, they were aberrations too. You just see a kind of immediate response by some of these legislators, which is obvious when you watch these videos why you would have that response. But more relevant is the fact that McConnell et al. Went right back to either quiet or supportive of what this was all about. And that's really the record that voters need to focus on.
And let me just read a couple of more comments as well. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Reaction to last night's first hearing of the investigation into the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Ankush, we talked about this earlier, but here's a comment from Thomas who says, is dereliction of duty a criminal offense? He goes on to say, in 1991, U.S. Court of Military Appeals case, U.S. v. Powell, the court stated that a person is guilty of the offense of dereliction of duty when he or she willingly or negligently fails to perform his or her duties, or by performing such duties in a culpably inefficient manner. As commander in chief, is Trump accountable? Can you respond to that?
So I'm not familiar with that case. It sounds like it took place maybe in a military setting, right, where they have
understandably
different settings,
yeah,
right, different standards for the conduct of military officers, understandably, right, where negligence can be a life or death thing on a daily basis. I'm not saying people should not be outraged over Trump's dereliction of duty. I'm definitely not saying people should vote for him. I'm just trying to sort of assess just straightforwardly the possibility that there would ever be a legal case against him on that theory. I think it's very remote, both as a legal matter and really more to the point as a political and practical matter, given who's in office and who's running the Justice Department.
I mean, it's kind of a broad-based question to you, Ankush, because we're in this new territory. And I remember Nixon saying, you know, if the president does it, it's not against the law. Are we in a similar state today?
I think we're pretty close to it.
Really?
I think we're close to it because, you know, I think what this committee is, what we're going to see from this committee, I think, is there's only so much fact gathering you can do. And a lot of it, you know, the success of investigation turns on what people provide you, how people comply, and how aggressively you look for it. And it's that last point that I think is really key to assessing the Justice Department's conduct here. I think they've been languorous to my mind in assessing and pursuing potential misconduct at the highest level of the administration, including, for instance, the Raffensperger call, but also conduct by Trump, people in his orbit, campaign officials, and the like. And, you know, you only find what you look for. And if, you know, they have sort of have their foot kind of halfway on the pedal, so to speak, in pursuing this, you know, that is going to end up setting a bit of a precedent, because I think if you don't take this seriously and look, you know, in a not in a politically motivated way, but in a real sharp, focused, aggressive way, given the stakes here, then you are going to incentivize this sort of conduct in the future.
Hmm. Here's a comment from Edward. I'll put this to you, Julian. He says, I think the one fact that is telling is that the Proud Boys were there at the Capitol before President Trump ever started speaking. And that's something we learned from the documentarian who told them to take to the Capitol, show that Trump actually did and Trump is over. But no one can say that the attempted coup is really due to the Proud Boys. I mean, this sort of takes us into some of the weeds, but, you know, who said what, where, when, and how? Kind of like what Baker said during Watergate. What did the president know, and when did he know it?
Well, it sounds like the connection is going to be important. I don't know the minutia of the timing, but the Proud Boys were featured, really, in day one through the documentary and through the discussion. So I think I assume we're going to hear more about the specifics of that connection. Obviously, there was the famous moment in the presidential debate where the former president was asked about condemning white supremacist groups, and he told the Proud Boys to stand down and stand by. I believe that was the quote. Mm-hmm. So some of this, again, it's right there in front of us. But I think given that first day, they are going to fill more of this out. And having that documentary and having recorded so much of this, there might be more evidence, again, of the connections between far-right extremist groups involved in violence and a presidential administration than we have at this point.
And Julian, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but I'm thinking of the Watergate hearings of 1973, Iran-Contra in the 1990s. Are there lessons from those particular hearings that are relevant today?
Well, sure. I mean, the Watergate hearings are a lesson, an example of what Congress can do to hold people accountable and to move public opinion. The Iran-Contra, though, is an example where even with a lot of evidence of wrongdoing and abuse of power, sometimes they don't have the political effect that some of the supporters of the committee are hoping for. Reagan survived, Republicans survived. Reagan ended his presidency very popular, despite some damning evidence that came out during those hearings about what had happened.
Hmm. Well, we got to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Julian Zelizer, as always, thanks for being a guest on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He's a CNN contributor and editor of a new book called The Presidency of Donald Trump, A First Historical Assessment. Ankush Kadari, thank you for joining us on Radio Times once again.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a contributing writer for New York Magazine, a contributing editor for Politico, and a former federal prosecutor. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler, who scurried in this morning to get all those clips together. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.